from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1 month from today, the 10-year-old federal ban on assault weapons sales is set to expire. Gun sellers are giddy with anticipation of the Uzis and AK-47s and Tech-9 pistols they'll be able to sell again in America at 12:01 a.m. on September 14th. Public outrage at the toll of these guns drove them off American shelves a decade ago. Presidential politics now appears ready to bring them back. Tonight on Point, banned assault weapons almost back on sale in America. But first, we begin tonight in New York, where the unusual auction for shares in Google Inc.'s highly anticipated initial public offering got underway today. Google's IPO was nearly delayed because of an interview with the founders of the online search engine that was published in Playboy magazine today during what is supposed to be a quiet period for executives of a company going public. But the bigger question may be about the outcome of the Google auction itself. Mike Santoli, senior editor at Barron's, is covering the story. Mike, thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks.
First, on the Playboy front, remind us why it's a no-no for this interview to be appearing today as these shares go to auction.
Yeah, securities regulators like it when a company that's about to go public restricts all of its comments to the official public offering documents that are filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. That's generally interpreted as basically a ban on other public remarks that do not get that same type of dissemination.
They don't just like it. They more or less require it, don't they? How did Google wiggle out of this today?
More or less require it, but you know, there's some indications late today that this will not derail the offering. Google effectively pasted the entire Playboy interview into the latest version of its offering document, which seems to have kind of placated the folks at the SEC. I think also there's a little bit of leeway. If you do not seem to actually be marketing and hyping your offering in these public statements, they might be able to have a little bit of flexibility there. So that seems to be what happened here.
So the point is, when a company is going public, the SEC wants all its statements to be sober, kind of legal statements, not the kind of hype that could appear in a mass media publication.
That's right. Yes, they want it to be kind of laced with all the potential risks and all the caveats that would go into a legal document.
Now, it looks like they've sidestepped that. The auction will go ahead. There's a lot of question as we talk tonight about whether or not the price that these shares end up at is going to fall in the range that Google has projected. What's the word on that?
There is some genuine question about that. It seems as if the enthusiasm for the offering has kind of drained away a little bit since they first discussed going public. Part of that is, of course, the broader market environment for tech stocks and stocks in general, which has weakened considerably. And part of it is the sort of high nominal price on these shares that Google at least kind of estimated they would go at well above $100 per share. That seems to perhaps have dampened a little bit of the public interest. You know, another thing that has dampened a little bit of the participation here is the fact that even though it was supposed to be a very widely open and democratic auction process, mm-hmm. the brokerage firms that are running the auction are actually setting their own standards in terms of who is qualified to bid for the shares. In other words, some brokerage firms might require you to have a certain net worth or a certain amount of experience investing before you can participate. So it seems to have potentially diluted a little bit of the interest.
So these young founders of Google, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, 31 and 30 years old, soon to become, I don't know, you tell me, billionaires or multi-hundred millionaires themselves.
Multi-billionaires, I would say, yeah.
All right. They wanted a very democratic offering here that everybody could participate in, but you're saying the brokerage firms themselves kind of tightened the noose around that participation.
They did, and I think it was largely because they were concerned about liabilities on their own front, if perhaps they were able to sell these shares to whoever came along. And in fact, it turned out that the stock went down, and they perhaps, you know, there's a certain requirement among broker firms that they have to only sell investments that are suitable to the client. So I think mm-hmm. that's what's going on here.
So here we are, and we're in what's called a Dutch auction. Very unusual. What is that, and why is Google being offered by that system?
It is very unusual. Effectively, everybody who would like shares is able to bid for a certain number of shares they would like at a given price. And so they can effectively dictate the terms at which they would like to purchase shares. And what will happen then is Google will take in all of those bids and determine the price at which they are able to sell all of the shares they would like to sell, and then everybody who has bid at that level or above that level gets the price, gets the shares at that price. So it's fairly complicated, but it actually is relatively fair in terms of determining a kind of a price where the seller and buyer meet at the perfect optimal point. Now, that's perfectly optimal for the seller and the buyer if you don't hope for the stock to change in price very much. So it's not like a regular IPO where there's often a built-in cushion so that the stock price could get a little bit of an upward bump right out of the gate. So right now, that's the process that's going on. The bidding began today and will be completed sometime next week.
There was a lot of complaint about that kind of bump that many IPOs had in the go-go 90s, where investment bankers and preferred investors got a huge updraft in just in the first day or week. Something would come out at 20 and go to 60.
Oh, and that would have been a modest increase in those heady days. And, you know, it's interesting because even though the Google founders wanted to avoid that kind of, you know, sort of insider handing out of easy profits, what's gone on now is that you have a lot of public investors who might actually be subject to what they call the winner's curse in auctions when, you know, the person who actually wins the auction probably, you know, paid a full price or maybe a little more than a full price. And that could be the sort of bittersweet result of this whole process.
And what happens, Mike, if the final price ends up below the range that Google was projecting? Below, what is it, 108 to 130 something? What if it comes in at 80 or 90? What happens?
Well, I mean, Google was just making an estimate there when they were setting that estimated range, and presumably they will simply adjust the price to get the deal done if, in fact, they have to. Now, it's always their prerogative to just decide not to actually do the offering at all and sort of walk away. Or they could, I suppose, shrink the number of shares down that they want to sell and then try to get a higher price from there. It's not at all clear how that would go, actually.
But one way or another, off it will go, it appears now, and billions for an online search engine wouldn't have meant anything 10, 15 years ago.
No. In fact, not even that many years ago. What's interesting, though, too, is that this company is far larger and much more profitable than most of those internet IPOs. In fact, they might have seen their fastest growth rates that they're going to see already. So they're much more mature, even though they're very young.
Mike Santoli, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Mike Santoli is a senior editor at Barron's. He joined us from New York. In 1994, after an extraordinary alignment of brutal killings and national politics, Congress took on what is always one of the toughest political firefights around, a battle with the gun lobby, and won a ban on the sale of 19 types of semi-automatic rifles and machine pistols, so-called assault weapons. But there were catches. First, the ban required renewal after 10 years. Those years are nearly up. And the ban had significant loopholes. Gunmakers were able to make and sell near copycat versions of the banned guns by making minor changes in their construction. Some gun control advocates still think the ban helped reduce gun violence. Others say it needs major strengthening. But instead, politicking from all sides appears to be killing it off. And President Bush, despite words of support for the ban, appears to be letting it die. Tonight on Point, the vanishing assault weapons ban and the politics behind its demise. Does America need Uzis and AK-47s for sale over the counter at your local gun shop? How do you read the politics of the amazing vanishing weapons ban? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Wes Allison, Washington reporter for the St. Petersburg Times, who's been writing about the impending sunset of the assault weapons ban. Wes, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Remind us of the confluence of events and politics that brought this ban to be in the first place, Wes.
Well, it came about at a time that there is strong public disgust with a series of mass killings. There was a shoot-up at the cafeteria in Killeen, Texas, and I think seven people killed on the Long Island Railway.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, assault weapons were seen as sort of a needless thing. The ban almost died in Congress. It was brought back to life by President Clinton. And one of the only ways they were able to get it through the Congress in 1994 was by promising that after 10 years the ban would either expire or would have to be renewed.
It was a $30 billion crime bill that it was part of. An extraordinary group of supporters got behind it, including former Republican presidents Ronald Reagan, who of course was the target of an assassination attempt, and George Bush, 41, the first President Bush. But here we are now. The 10 years are up. There's plenty of controversy about what's worked and not worked about the ban. But if I read the signs correctly, this thing appears to be headed for the ash bin of history. Is that right, Wes?
At this point, I don't see there's no reason to believe that they'll renew the ban. It's essentially dead. And the chances of bringing it back again with the Republican Congress and Republican administration, I think, are slim to none. It's just not a political winner right now for the Republicans to bring this up. President Bush has always said he supports the ban. He'll sign it if they bring it to his desk. But he's not in the business of telling the House and the Senate what to do. The House particularly says, well, if the president really wanted this, he could push for it. Speaker Hastert has said that he could get it to the floor if the president really wanted it. But that's not happening. So you have this sort of catch-22 where neither side has taken the initiative.
Wes Allison, what has happened here? There's public outrage that pushed this into being a decade ago. Have people just forgotten? Has the NRA grown stronger? Is it because it's coming right into the teeth of a presidential election campaign? Why are politicians so sensitive about keeping AK-47s and Uzis off the street? Whatever the NRA may think, I've seen surveys that say overwhelming majority of Americans want them off the street.
Yeah, and that's true. It's huge. It's like 70% of Americans say they do. Even among NRA members, the number is very high.
So where's the leverage? Where's the sensitivity here?
I think, A, people forgot about it. They didn't realize, it was a big deal when it happened, and they didn't pay too much attention to that sunset clause. And then, B, for the Republicans, the NRA, it's one more skirmish in the culture wars, and gun control is an important issue for the more conservative wing of the Republican Party. And those are people that George Bush desperately needs to come out en masse in November.
But are the Democrats pushing hard to get this up? Are they raising a ruckus on Capitol Hill?
Some of them are. There have been several press conferences outside the Capitol. Congresswoman McCarthy from New York, whose husband was killed on the Long Island Railway, she's been a big advocate of this. It's what got her into politics. She's held press conferences. But usually there's been no more than 10 fellow Democrats and a couple Republicans there. The Democrats aren't wild about pushing gun control as an issue. This is an election they know they need to be seen as moderate. They don't want gun control is not a winner for them either in this one.
And John Kerry has been posing out hunting more than once, as I recall.
Absolutely. And even on his under his position statements. I mean, he's for the assault weapons ban, but it's not something he's been pushing.
Wes Allison, because I know the details are complicated, and we're going to get into them here, remind us exactly what this banned and what it didn't ban, and the loopholes.
That's very interesting. It's really not the loopholes are many. First of all, any banned gun that was already in the market could stay on the market. It didn't take guns away from people.
Right.
What it did is it banned the sale and manufacture of new guns.
Mm-hmm.
It also, in addition to those 19 models of machine pistols and machine guns, what it banned were what gun shop guys call evil features. You could only have a limited number of these evil features.
Such as?
Including high-capacity magazines.
So to have 10 or more bullets in the magazine.
Correct. Flash suppressors, folding stocks, which make a machine pistol very easy to conceal in like a jacket or something,
mm-hmm.
or a bag, and then you can pull it out and pull the stock out. So those are some of the things that it also banned. When I talk to gun store owners about this, they don't think this is going to have a huge impact on most people. Frankly, there's so many of these guns already out there that it's really impossible to say what the market for it really is if it changes. The NRA says that there's that it's had no effect on crime. That's certainly very debatable. But these guns aren't used in a wide percentage of violent crimes. The problem is when they are used, they're very, very deadly.
And what a symbol. And yet we do read gun dealers licking their chops, news of boatloads of these guns headed toward the United States in anticipation of the ban coming off. They will be back on the shelves.
That's true. And a lot of these are going to be made from overseas. I checked with some American gun manufacturers, and this is not something they're really – they don't really see themselves competing with foreign-made AK-47s and things like that.
Wes Allison, stand by. We're going to be talking in just a moment with Congresswoman Carolyn McCarthy, whose husband was killed in one of the incidents that led to this gun ban. We are talking tonight about the vanishing assault weapons ban and why Congress is about to let it go. Does America need Uzis and AK-47s for sale again over the counter at your local gun shop? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the vanishing assault weapons ban and why Congress is about to let it go. 1 month from today, the 10-year-old assault weapons ban expires. Congress does not appear to be set to renew it. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you remember when every American gun store looked like it could arm the Marines? Why are we headed there again? And how do you read the politics of the vanishing weapons ban? Why aren't Republicans or Democrats going to the mat on this? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or do you think we should let those assault weapons sales roll? We've been joined tonight from Washington by Wes Allison, Washington reporter for the St. Petersburg Times. We're joined now from Washington, D.C. by Congresswoman Carolyn McCarthy. She's a member of Congress, a Democrat from New York. Her husband was one of the six people killed in the Long Island Railroad shooting in 1993. Congresswoman McCarthy, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure being here. I've been listening to the conversation, and I think, you know, it's important to bring up that since the assault weapons ban became reality, 66% over the last 10 years, we've seen crimes committed with assault weapons drop. That in alone, I think, is a very good statistic. You hear from the NRA, I've been watching every story that's been going on across the country, basically stating that it has done nothing. That why is every major police force across this country supporting renewing the ban? They know what's going to happen when these guns go back on the street. It is harder to buy them today. Yes, there's still a lot out there, but we've done a great job on cutting the guns of choice for criminals and drug dealers to be off the street. The large capacity clips. You know, the NRA debated me a number of times, saying it wouldn't have done anything to help anybody on the Long Island Railroad.
But this was the case there. It wasn't a semi-automatic weapon, but it was a pistol with a large capacity clip, so the shooter could keep on shooting.
Colin Ferguson was able to put in three clips that had 15 bullets into a clip. It certainly, unfortunately, wouldn't have helped my son or my husband in the beginning. But you talk to those young people and the families of those young people on the other end of the train before the great heroes were able to tackle this guy down, their lives might have been saved.
And he was tackled when he had to change clips, so the size of clip mattered there.
It did matter, and it matters a lot.
But you stood outside the Capitol building in the middle of July with an Uzi in your hands, trying to dramatize the point that this is going away. It doesn't seem to be getting much of a rise out of your fellow congressmen.
Well, you know, since I've been in Congress, we actually have 136 members, Republicans and Democrats, on the bill. We know we have a number of more. They won't go on the bill because they don't want to put their name on the bill, but they said they would vote for it if it came up to the floor for a vote. But what it comes down to, and it was brought out earlier in the show, that the president has to get behind this. When you had a Ronald Reagan and you had Bush 1 pushing this, it was for a reason. It was because they knew they could save lives. Now, I'm not saying that we, under gun safety issues, can save every life. We can. It's going to be impossible. The criminals will be able to get guns. That's something that this country will never be able to change. But when we have something that is working, I do believe that we should keep it in place. And it was brought out 70% of the American people are supporting it. 66% of gun owners are supporting it. These are responsible people, not into the far right wing of whether a Democrat or a Republican, it doesn't matter. These can, you know, we can save lives. Why would we turn back on something like this?
But as we sit here tonight, speaking about this, what are the odds? What's the reality check? What are the odds that this expires 1 month from today?
Well, we're definitely putting a big push on. I know the president got over 20,000 emails last week, and we're doing that with House Speaker Hastert, and we're just trying to put a lot of pressure in every part of this country onto people. I know this is not what the average citizen thinks about. This is what the NRA is pushing to get their members to call in and say, don't do this, don't do this. But the average American person, unfortunately, doesn't look at gun violence until it hits them.
Congresswoman McCarthy, thank you for joining us tonight.
Absolutely. And I would ask all your listeners to please get involved in this. It could make a difference in a community and certainly to a school and certainly to our police officers across the country. Mm.
Carolyn McCarthy, member of Congress, Democrat from New York. Her husband was one of the six people killed in the Long Island Railroad shooting in 1993. Wes Allison, her story is a painful and direct one, but as she says, most people, of course, are not touched by this in the course of their regular lives. It can fade.
You know, that's true, and that's one of the hard things about it. I mean, when they passed this, there had been several, you know, several very high-profile disasters that had happened, and including the Long Island shooting, including the Clean Texas Cafe shooting, and a shooting here at Washington, D.C. Police Department. But, you know, when you look back to the last presidential election, there's a concern by the Democrats that gun control cost Al Gore both Tennessee, his home state, as well as West Virginia. And for some Republicans, especially, you know, the Blue Dog Republicans, the moderate Republicans, the assault weapons ban is not something they want to push right now. I mean, they'd rather win than push this one issue. And I'm not sure that they're right that this would cost them the election. But
as you write, it they believe it hurt them with white working class voters. They don't want to be bitten by that again.
Absolutely. And those are people the Democrat Party has to get back if they're going to win, especially in the South.
An election year can create all kinds of dynamics. Wes Allison, thanks for joining us tonight.
Certainly. Thank you for having me anytime.
Wes Allison, Washington reporter for the St. Petersburg Times. We're talking tonight about the vanishing assault weapons ban. It goes away, 10 years old, goes away 1 month from today. I'm joined now from Tallahassee, Florida, by Gary Kleck. He's professor of criminology and criminal justice at Florida State University, author of several books, including most recently Point Blank, Guns and Violence in America. Gary Kleck, thanks for joining us tonight.
You're welcome, Tom.
And from Washington by Daniel Weiss, a staff attorney at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Daniel Weiss, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Dan Weiss, to you first. If you could give us the survey data, what do they show about the effectiveness of this 10-year ban on assault weapon sales? Has it made a real difference or not?
Yeah, it's been a staggering difference. We looked at crime gun trace data, thousands of crime guns, to determine whether the assault weapons ban was working. We found a dramatic 66% decline in the use of assault weapons in crime. Gun homicides peaked when the assault weapons ban was passed at 18,000 in the country. It's now dropped to under 11,000. That's a huge decline. And luckily, we haven't seen the types of mass shootings that we saw before the ban. For example, before the ban took effect in California, a man took an AK-47 to a schoolyard, fired over 100 rounds in less than 2 minutes, and shot 34 children, killed five of them. Thankfully, things like that have not happened within the last 10 years in any sort of regularity like they were before the ban, and that's why all major law enforcement groups are behind renewal of the ban.
And yet, Gary Kleck, there are many, even gun control advocates, who have been far from satisfied with the effect of this ban. I think you're one of them. What's your critique?
Well, at no point were assault weapons ever commonly used. Maybe 1.8% of crimes committed with guns in America prior to the ban involved assault weapons broadly construed. And
but is that an argument for keeping them in every cupboard and closet or not?
Well, it's not going to make a dime's worth of difference one way or another if they're all eminently replaceable. You were discussing loopholes earlier, and I don't know if you'd want to call a designed feature of legislation a loophole, but it was basically designed to be, you know, a loophole kind of a piece of legislation because mechanically crime-wise, the guns that were left unbanned were identical to the ones that were left banned.
What do you mean exactly? We heard Wes Allison say that the ban only applied to new from the manufacturer guns, so there were lots of old ones around. But what was the rest of the loophole you're describing, or the design?
Even in terms of brand spanking new guns, mm-hmm. there were new guns being manufactured that were essentially exactly like the ones that were banned. It's not just the older stock of guns was still available, but you know, you could have a gun that fired just as fast, that was also semi-automatic, that was just as lethal shot for shot, and buy it for the same price.
And it wasn't banned because it didn't fall under the technical specifications that this ban covered somehow?
Well, it wasn't on the list. For the most part, the guns got banned because they were on a list of specific makes and models, and it was deliberately kept to be a limited list. That was part of the political compromise. So it was 20-some models of guns, and there were hundreds of other models of guns that were allowed to be continued to sell on sale. So
you're a professor of criminology. What are you suggesting here, that the ban should be broadened and strengthened, or that it's not involved in a high enough percentage of American crimes and deaths to even be messed with?
No, I think we ought to understand we got into this situation as a result of political decisions, not decisions about what would be a sensible way to control gun violence. If we want to actually do something about the violence problem, you back up and say a focus on specific subtypes of guns is a mistake, regardless of, you know, how broad the subset or what loopholes you manage to close up. The idea that you should focus on particular subtypes of guns was a mistake from the very beginning.
And would you say that even to a parent of one of those dozens of children who were mowed down in a California schoolyard in 2 minutes?
I would say that especially to them, and I think once they understood the facts, they'd be the first to agree that the point is there are people out there who should not possess any type of gun. It's silly to say it's bad that they possess this particular make and model of gun, but you can have another make and model of gun, and that's just fine.
So you're saying register who? Register criminals? Register all-American gun purchases? Is that where you're going?
No, you should make some serious effort to enforce the existing prohibitions. Right now, it's illegal for any convicted criminal to possess any type of firearm anywhere in the United States. That's already law, has been law for decades, which means you don't need any additional laws to say criminals shouldn't have guns of any type. And that's not limited to particular subtypes like assault weapons. Do something serious to actually enforce those laws.
Daniel Weiss, join us here for a moment. Gary Kleck suggesting that it's silly to focus on a subset of guns, however lethal they may be, when there are so many near copycats out there and criminals are buying guns all over anyway. What do you say?
Well, it's very interesting to say that on the one hand, the ban doesn't cover certain military-style weapons, and then to conclude from that we should scrap the ban entirely. We know that gun crime has dropped dramatically because of the assault weapons ban. We know that we can strengthen the assault weapons ban, but at the minimum, we should renew it. We should keep these military-style weapons off the street. And politically, the Senate is on record. The Senate voted in March to reauthorize the ban. A majority of the Senate voted to reauthorize the ban, although it was part of a larger bill that was brought down. We think the votes are in the House, but the House leadership has said, we're not even going to allow a vote on it unless President Bush asks us to, and he hasn't. Polls in swing states and key battleground states in the presidential campaign found that independent voters overwhelmingly support it and that this could be a deciding issue for many of them. So I think if the Republican Party thinks that they shouldn't, they should be afraid of the NRA and they shouldn't bring this up, that could seriously backfire. And in an election this close, that could make the difference.
Daniel Weiss, Gary Kleck, I want to begin to bring our callers in here. Gabriel's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Gabriel. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am an unapologetic Michael Dukakis liberal.
Okay.
But I think that the Democrats have really lost their way on this issue and have completely gone in the wrong direction.
You mean banning assault weapons was the wrong direction in your view?
Oh, absolutely. I think they've forgotten their whole heritage from the Minutemen of the Revolutionary War through the Union veterans who formed the National Rifle Association after they won the Civil War.
You mean the submachine guns on the Lexington Green and the AK-47s used for deer hunting?
Oh, they were the submachine guns and AK-47s of their time. Those weapons were superior to the British weapons, and that is why we won those battles, because we had the police of the time, the redcoats, outgunned.
So you're saying Democrats stand up for the American right to bear arms, including assault weapons?
And I would say further this, I'm really afraid that John Kerry is going to lose this election by demagoguing this issue when the expiration comes up near, and he's going to, you know, turn out his base in Los Angeles, Boston, and New York, while he loses crucial swing votes in Ohio, Florida, and Pennsylvania.
Gabriel, I want to understand you, and I should say, I'm looking at polls here that show a lot of opposition, even in some of those states you're talking about, but I want to understand, are you saying you oppose the assault weapons ban because you're a Second Amendment supporter, or because you just think it's bad political calculus for the Democrats to frown on gun ownership?
Both with equal fervor. And what I want to see John Kerry do is get into the Senate and propose a compromise that will put the assault weapons under the same background check regulations as the Brady Bill, treat them just like you treat concealed handguns, which are the far greater criminal threat, and get away from this banning situation. And I'm just afraid John Kerry's not going to do that. He's going to demagogue the issue, try to make himself out to be more anti-gun than George Bush is.
Well, George Bush is on the record as being against this, but let us pick it all up, Gabriel, and thanks for your perspective. We're joined now from Fairfax, Virginia, by John Lott. He's a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, author of More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Gun Control Laws. John Lott, thanks for joining us tonight. That sounds like a voter after your own heart.
Well, I think it's heading in the right direction. Can I just clarify something? You talk about earlier military-style weapons. The key thing here is style. These are not the same types of guns that are used in the military. When you use the term AK-47, these are civilian versions of AK-47.
Right,
these are not the same types of weapons. The outside is the same, but the guts of the gun is a semi-automatic gun. Most of the gun, not a machine gun. And a lot of these polls, I think, are based upon people's misperception that we're talking about machine guns here or something. We're talking about the inside. Most of the guns sold in the United States are semi-automatic.
Yeah, I understand, and I think we've been clear on that. It's not the same as what the Marines are carrying around Fallujah, and yet...
No, it's just like a regular hunting rifle, only the outside looks different.
But you know, the speed of the bullet delivery is not the same, certainly, as
exactly
a 22. No, well,
it's
no,
exactly,
it's not.
It's the mechanics. The inside guts of the gun are exactly the same. They fire the same size bullet with the same rapidity, doing the exact same damage. In fact, you can use this for hunting deer.
Of course you can. We take your point that there are different styles here, and some of it is just style. There are issues of speed and delivery.
No. And besides that, I'll just mention, there's not one academic study. I mean, we've had this law for 10 years now, and yet none of the studies that were funded by the Clinton administration, such as one done by the Urban Institute, and none of the academic studies that I know of, have found any benefit in terms of reducing violent crime significantly, murder, any type of violent crime, as a result of these laws.
Daniel Weiss, I thought I heard you quoting some kind of statistics that would suggest otherwise.
Well,
right, and I'll quote to you from that Urban Institute study, which Mr. Lott just spoke about. In that study, the Justice Department commissioned the study and looked at the short-term effect of the assault weapons ban, because that was in 1999. They found that it led to assault weapons, quote, becoming less accessible to criminals because there was at least a short-term decrease in criminal use of the banned weapons.
And that's very selective. If you read the entire thing, Chris Coper and Jeff Roth, who are the authors of that, said that they could not find any statistically significant change in the only times that they could get even what appeared to be a drop was when they would condition it on looking at the states that had some type of juvenile gun law. I mean, you could see they must have gone through I don't know how many permutations to just look at one specific combination of results, and even then they couldn't find one statistically significant result.
We hear the argument. We've got to take a break here. As we go out, I want to thank John Lott at the American Enterprise Institute for joining us tonight, and Daniel Weiss at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Listeners, you can join us. We're talking about the vanishing assault weapons ban and why Congress is about to let it go. Is this the same old constitutional debate? Is every American entitled to their semi-automatic rifle, their Tech 9 machine pistol? We're 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the vanishing assault weapons ban. It will expire 1 month from today. Talking about why Congress is about to let it go, to let it expire. You can join the conversation tonight. If American police forces are for the ban, why is Congress against it? How do you read the politics of the vanishing weapons ban? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We've been joined tonight from Tallahassee, Florida, by Gary Kleck, professor of criminology and criminal justice at Florida State University. We are joined now from Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Russell Lane. He is chief of police in Algonquin, Illinois, and vice president of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Russell Lane, thanks for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Tom.
So here we are, 1 month to go, and the ban will be gone. We've heard that it's been nothing like a a perfect net here. A lot has gotten through, and yet police chiefs like yourself, as far as I know, are pretty solidly against letting the ban die. Why?
Absolutely, Tom. Our association represents over 16,000 law enforcement executives in the United States, and we overwhelmingly support the renewal of the assault weapons ban. We feel that it's a community safety issue. It's a public safety issue. It's the safety of our officers. Since the ban's been in effect, there's been a decrease in the number, the availability of the assault weapons, and we think that it's better for our communities.
Russell Lane, your fellow guest Gary Kleck suggested it's kind of a Band-Aid, that an awful lot of weapons out there anyway, that it's a small percentage of the weapons used in crimes, that there ought to be better ways to control guns than this one relatively narrow ban. What do you say to that?
Well, there certainly are some loopholes, and I'd have to agree with that. But we believe that this ban should be renewed, and then from there we work on those loopholes and maybe craft some better legislation to take care of that.
Gary Kleck, what do you say to Russell Lane? His guy's in the line of duty. He wants the ban maintained.
Well, I think the reasoning seems to be, well, you know, if a little bit helps a little bit, then a lot would help a lot. And there's no evidence that this little bit helped at all. Basically, if you're going to eliminate 1.8% of the guns criminals use, it's easy to find substitutes for all of them. So the idea that just fixing loopholes is going to do some good is crazy. What's called for is a different strategy altogether, which is basically focusing on keeping guns away from criminals, any type of gun.
And yet we hear the question, why let the ban go? While you're working on that, if you're working on that, let's turn to our callers. Patrick is calling from Boston. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I just don't understand why there is actually any debate about this, Republican or Democratic, because in this day and age, we're supposed to be worried about terrorists coming in with whatever type of weapon, and we're just going to put this back on the street.
I guess it's there, Patrick, because as we're reading here, white working class voters in some considerable number don't want gun controls and have voted against parties that support them. What does that leave you thinking?
Kind of sick.
I know the feeling. Patrick, thanks for your call. Russell Lane, President Bush is on the record saying it makes no sense for assault weapons to be around our society. But he's not going to bat on this, even though he said he's for extending the ban. He's not pushing, and the congressional leaders are saying without a push, they're not going to move. I'm reading here in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, no liberal newspaper. Their editorial says, apparently, President Bush's war on terror, domestic as well as foreign, is not as important as keeping peace with the National Rifle Association. Is that where you see the heart of the pushback against this ban?
Well, I don't know where the pushback is coming from. We really believe that, you know, it's a community safety issue, and partisan politics has no place in this. This is about our communities making them safer and the safety of our officers on the front lines.
But we've heard from Gary Kleck and from others tonight that the statistics aren't there to show a big enough margin of difference because of this ban. Do you believe that? Are you afraid that on September 14th you're going to see a raft of new sales of new semi-automatic rifles?
Well, we know that there'll be an increase. We don't know what stockpiled, where they're going to come from, but I'm sure there's going to be an increase. We've seen a decrease. These are the favored weapons of our gangbangers, of the drug dealers, of other criminals.
I've got a report here, Italian officials saying that in April they intercepted 8,000 AK-47s smuggled out of a Romanian port bound for a gun dealer in Georgia in anticipation of the ban going off. Richard's calling from Boston. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for putting me on.
Sure.
I'm just dumbfounded at the tenor of some of the people speaking against the ban on assault weapons. This is not 150 years ago or 200 or 400 years ago. We're not here trying to protect ourselves from the British. We're talking about what is the design and use of a weapon like an AK-47, even if it's a civilian version or the AR-15. I was on a high school rifle team. I'm familiar with guns. I've shot, been hunting. There is no justification for these weapons being anywhere. It's lunacy, and I'm appalled that people should bring up these red herrings. It is a matter of safety for civilians, for police, for all of us.
And yet it appears to be going away. You know, Congress is in recess. When it comes back, it's only back for a very few days, hardly even time enough to mount a renewal of this ban, even if they wanted to. How do you understand the politics of that, Richard?
Well, what I understand is that when I get done with this call, I'm going to call up my senators and my congressmen and ask them to do everything they can to make sure the ban is renewed. And I'm going to email or call the White House, whichever seems to be the better way to get into them these days.
Sound like a man with a mission, Richard. Thank you very much for calling. Gary Click, I had to cut you off earlier when you wanted to offer an alternative vision of how to get at this general gun problem. Lay it out for us.
Well, the focus should be on either preventing criminals from getting a hold of guns, any type of guns in the first place, or if you fail at that, then preventing them from bringing them to the place where they're going to hurt somebody or victimize somebody, which means enforcing laws against illegal carrying of guns through public places.
You just don't believe in the restriction of the supply of guns itself as an avenue of addressing gun violence?
Well, not the overall supply. Certainly the overall supply. You can't prevent guns from getting into criminals' hands just by producing marginal reductions in the overall supply. I mean, you know, there's only a few hundred thousand guns needed to commit all the crimes in America, and there's, you know, in excess of 280 million guns in the stock. So, you know, we could eliminate half of the guns, and that's not going to even come close to bringing it down to a point where it produces any significant scarcity for criminals.
And yet for people who are afraid of being hit by this, who wish there were fewer, it may be a sad day on September 13th. Russell Lane, at this point, do you have any expectation that this ban is going to be saved?
Well, we're going to keep on working. Our membership is reaching out to their representatives. I know myself, I've participated in some other news conferences along with a senator and congresswoman from Illinois. So we're going to keep on working at it.
Well, there's the police chief speaking. Russell Lane, chief of police in Algonquin, Illinois, vice president of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Thank you for being with us tonight from Albuquerque.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And Gary Click, professor of criminology and criminal justice at Florida State University, author of Point Blank, Guns and Violence in America. Thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, as the 28th Olympiad kicks off, a look back at the ancient Olympic Games. This is On Point. With a lavish ceremony that invoked Greek mythology and culture, the games of the 28th Olympiad opened earlier today in Athens. It was a homecoming of two sorts for the Olympic Games. The first modern Olympiad was held in Athens in 1896, and, of course, the ancient Olympics were held for 1,200 years in Greece until Christian Emperor Theodosius II banned all pagan festivals in 392 A.D., The ancient Olympics were very different from the modern games. There were no female athletes. All except chariot racing events were performed in the nude. The penalty for a false start in a race was a thrashing from the official whip bearer. And while there were no high-tech doping scandals, contestants were required to swear that they did not use magic to enhance their performance. Tony Perrotte is the author of The Naked Olympics, The True Story of the Ancient Games. In this radio diary, he takes us inside the original games.
Some of the sports we would recognize today, I mean, the javelin is very similar, the discus, the long jump is somewhat similar, except it was done from a standing start instead of a running start, and it was actually done to flute music as well, and the athletes would have these hand weights that they would swing back and forth rhythmically to the flute music. The running we would sort of recognize with a couple of oddities. The stadium was straight, so they would run back and forth around these columns. There were no marathons, no team sports. And some of the other sports have kind of fallen by the wayside. The chariot race, for example, a very spectacular event, very dangerous, these sort of nail-biting turns where there'd be accidents all the time. The Greeks loved it. They would gather at either end of the hippodrome, just, you know, drooling over the gore and the devastation. After the race, it was compared sometimes to a battlefield, the carnage, you know, people dragging themselves, you know, hideous injury. The climactic event was called the Pancration, and it's basically a no-holds-barred brawl. The closest thing we could possibly imagine is Thai kickboxing, but it has to be combined with something much more visceral and much more dramatic, because you try and knock one another out with the kicking, and of course these guys are competing in the nude, so it's, as you can imagine, quite a hair-raising event. I have to cross my legs even thinking about it. So if they can't knock each other out with the kicking, they go in grappling. The only thing that's banned is eye gouging, so there's breaking of bones. In fact, one guy who was nicknamed Mr. Digits, that was his speciality, going and breaking fingers one by one until his opponent submitted. And that's the only way you can gain victory, I should add, is if your opponent gives up. The surest way of doing that is through strangulation, and the sources say that the judges heartily approved of strangulation. It was the only real way that you could guarantee that someone was going to either surrender or die. Quite often at the Olympics, athletes preferred death over defeat. It was very humiliating to be defeated at the Games. If you won, you were regarded as a demigod. If you lost, you were humiliated. There were no second prizes. There was no pat on the back for a pancration well played. And Pindar has these great poems, actually. The Olympic victor goes in this sort of white horse chariot, surrounded by his loved ones, back to his home city in the sort of ticker tape parade, whereas the loser has to skulk home through these back alleys, and he gets home and his mother won't even talk to him. It's just, you know, madness and suicide was often the lot of the loser at the Olympic Games. Fans had an incredibly uncomfortable time of it. Olympia is 210 miles, say, from Athens, so to get to the venue, you've basically got to walk. So you're trekking away for 10, 12 days. You turn up in Olympia, you're exhausted, you're dirty and whatever, and it's a very beautiful place, Olympia. It's a nice little sanctuary dedicated to Zeus, one of the most sacred places in the pagan world, but it has no spectator facilities whatsoever. So everyone just has to basically fend for themselves, throw out their bedding wherever they can. The ambience is very much like a badly planned rock concert today, sort of the Woodstock of antiquity. The other thing that's kind of staggering is that it's, because it's held at the height of the Mediterranean summer, the two rivers that converge in Olympia dry up. So there's this incredible water shortage. You've got people falling from heat stroke. It's incredibly hot in Greece in summer, as people will be finding out over in Athens right now. There are reports of deaths from dehydration. Even worse, there's a big insect problem in Olympia. So there's all these bugs everywhere. It gets so bad that before every Olympic Games, the priests of the area make this special sacrifice at an altar to Zeus, the averter of flies. The host city, which was called Elis, a small and very obscure place, really, in the Peloponnese, used to send out the sacred heralds all over Greece to declare a month before and a month after the games, the sacred truce would be enforced, whereby Zeus would protect all athletes and all spectators who wanted to get to the games, as well as the area of the games itself. Now, the United Nations wants to have a sort of a revival of the truce where all wars stop after the 2 weeks of the modern Olympic Games. Now, the Greeks were never so idealistic. All they wanted was to stop all wars that might affect the successful operation of the games or people getting to and from the games. So if you wanted to go have a war up in Thessaly, good on you. Go and do it. Slit each other's throats. Just had to not interfere with the successful operation of the games.
Tony Perrette is author of the new book, The Naked Olympics, The True Story of the Ancient Games. The 2004 Olympics opened earlier today in Athens. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Jane Manners, Tamar Morad, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.